So welcome everyone to this session where I'm super excited to be talking with Donna Gates. Donna, welcome. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you very much for even asking me, because I think we have a lot of juicy information to share.
Yeah, great. So we're going to be exploring in this interview sort of two topics that are very deeply connected. We're going to be looking at genes and genetics and the impact that that has. But we're also then going to be looking at digestion, and Donna has an enormous experience and pivotal role in raising awareness around fermented food. So we're going to bring those pieces together. Just for anyone that doesn't know Donna, just to give her professional bio, Donna Gates is an international best-selling author of The Body Ecology Diet and The Body Ecology Guide to Growing Younger. She's also on a mission to change the way the world eats. The Body Ecology Diet was the first of its kind, sugar-free, gluten-free, casein-free, and probiotic-rich. In 1994, Donna introduced the natural sweetener stevia to the US, began teaching about fermented foods, and coined the phrase inner ecosystem to describe the network of microbes that maintains our basic physiological processes, from digestion to immunity. Over the past 25 years, Donna has become one of the most respected authorities in the field of digestive health, diet, and nutrition. And in 2013, she completed an advanced fellow with the American Academy of Anti-Aging Medicine. Donna's extensive research and dedication to learning help her stay ahead of what's coming in the field of health and nutrition. Her latest passion is nutritional genomics. She will soon launch a training program for practitioners that confirms that body ecology is a gut-smart, gene-smart way of life. I should also say Donna earlier this year ran the fantastic Genius of Your Genes Summit, which I was very grateful to be invited to contribute to as well. So once again, Donna, thank you for joining me.
Thank you. That was a long bio. I was listening to myself thinking, my staff read that. I would not tell you all that stuff about myself, but thank you. Sounds great.
I think it's nice people to have the context. And, you know, I find myself reading about introducing stevia in 1994. And it just sort of makes me realize, you know, we're talking 25 years ago and over 25 yeah. years ago, and for how there, yeah. long you have been, you know, at the forefront of this field. And I think the, you know, things that these days people are discovering, like they think, oh my God, digestion, it's so important. And mm-hmm. it's people like you that have played the role in getting that into people's awareness. So
yeah, in the Body Ecology Diet book, I introduced this new substitute for sugar called stevia, and nobody knew about it yet. It was like totally undiscovered. And I brought it into the world. And then Ben Alto, the whole Frischer's never talk about this world in our gut called the microbiome, which in those days there wasn't that term. So I just made up the term inner ecosystem. And it took a long time, you know, like it takes 5-10 years sometimes before other people catch on and become interested. But, you know, the microbiome is the hottest thing now. And what's coming down the pipe for people that don't know this yet, nutritional genomics is next. Huge. It's going to take the world by storm, solve so many questions that we have, you know, like so many answers in nutritional genomics. I'm really glad you asked me to talk about both those topics.
Yeah, and I think, well, let's jump in there, because genetics is starting to get on the cultural radar in recent years, partly through some of the, 23andMe and some of these kind of mass mm-hmm, kind mm-hmm. of awareness tests that people can do. But just to sort of contextualize this, how important are our genetics? Like, what is the influence that they have on our health and well-being, be that our physical health or indeed our mental and emotional health?
You know, to answer that globally, in a sense, there's not a single thing they don't do. Like, we would be dead. We wouldn't be here if we didn't have our genes, because they're controlling everything in the body. So looking for neurotransmitters, for example, all of them are made by our genes. Then also vitamins and minerals, they're all made by our genes. And then, you know, another thing the genes do is some of them have important roles of transporting the genes, like there's a magnesium transporter. So we all know magnesium is important, and maybe we're taking plenty of it, but is it getting transported into the cells? Hormones, they control digestion. You know, there's just literally not one system in the body that you can think of that they're not like instructing. Like they are where everything starts. And, you know, I'm sure people have heard that, you know, they've been afraid that maybe they have the genes for a heart attack or genes for arthritis. And then, you know, experts in this field will come along and say, well, we control our genes. Well, yes, I'm a big believer that we need to know what our variants are, like where do we have weaknesses? So then we can support them or work around them. That's the great thing about knowing them. You'll still see people out there telling you that it's not looking at our genes is not ready for prime time. And I 100% disagree with that. Even though the word's getting out now, this field is already 30 years old. And it's just like computers where, you know, all the stuff that before we ever saw a big clunky computer, there's a lot of work going on for about 30 years. And then suddenly, you know, we saw this first big clunky thing. That's kind of where we are. We're kind of in a clunky stage, but quickly, there's a whole lot we know. And it's quickly evolving.
And I think sometimes people can be in some quite polarized perspective around genes. You can have people that say, oh, well, it's all down to my genetics. I'm utterly powerless. I can't do anything. It's all predetermined. And then you've got others that are sort of, well, you know, I refuse to be defined by my genes. It's everything is all down to my lifestyle and how I live. And I'd be kind of curious as to your thoughts of like, where is the truth in that? Like, how much can we influence?
Well, 100% sure we all have thousands of genetic variants. And so they're there. And if you're living a healthy lifestyle, they may, the variants, the problematic ones, may never be expressed, except that, you know, we happen to live in a world where we're maybe suddenly exposed to a lot of stress, or you get things like 5G put upon you. We can't eat as well as we want to. Our food is sprayed. All of a sudden, even if you're trying to do the right thing, one of the things I've become really aware of is DNA damage. So our DNA is very, very fragile, and we damage it all the time. Every time we do get stressed, the 5G, as I mentioned, is terribly damaging to the DNA. And also, as we get older, our ability to repair the DNA damage significantly decreases. So in a way, everybody's subject to, you know, a DNA failing for them in a sense. But then, you know, so I'm 74, and, you know, I don't have a lot of, I mean, for my age, I'm very active and my mind still works great and everything. And I still don't feel like I'm 74, but I am. And so it's made me realize all the things I've done, the self-discipline I've had over all these years. My genes, if I could look at them, actually, they're probably in pretty good condition, but for sure I'm aging. You know, so you can't stop that, because Mother Nature really doesn't want you here forever. Otherwise, where would there be room for the new little babies coming along too? But, and I'm okay with that. I mean, I don't want to be 115, like a lot of people are shooting for, and everybody I love is gone, you know, so that's not the goal. The goal is to keep your genes really working well together so that you can, you know, age well until you finally say, I'm ready to get out of here. That's what I'm all about.
And I think there's something.
I have a lot of SNPs, Eric. I mean, Alex, let me just say this. I have looked at my genes, and I have a lot of variants that are really working against me, diabetes and stress things and all. And so it's not that I got the lucky, you know, the lottery or something. I have a ton of bad genes for cancer, breast cancer, and things like that. So I just want to say that is you can reach a certain age and those genes aren't really working against you. So sorry.
Thank you. And I think there's something as well that's really like you just mentioned that, you know what your kind of vulnerabilities are, let's say. There's something that is very empowering about having that data, right? Because that can also become part of informing the health choices that and the lifestyle choices that one might make.
Completely. I'll give you a perfect example. I was rather surprised to see I have huge risk for diabetes and we don't have it anywhere in the family. And I thought, wow, that's surprising. And then I learned from when I was doing all my A4M work from Dr. Jonathan Wright in a hormone course, he mentioned that if you get like skin tags, and I had a couple skin tags, and he said that that's really insulin resistance. And I thought, well, I don't ever eat sugar. You know, I eat fermented foods. I do a lot of things to keep my insulin resistance low. But if I have a couple of skin tags, I'm not doing a good job. And then I thought, but I don't eat sugar. And then I realized, so what else would raise my glucose and my cortisol? You know, I thought, wow, stress. For sure, I have a lot of stress because I love life and I like to do too much. I put too much on my plate and all that. So then I realized it's not a matter of controlling my diet or changing my diet. I got that. It was the stress that became the major focus of everything I do from now on. That's just a good example.
Yeah, so definitely. And I think it's probably a good place to say a little bit about some of the genetic SNPs that can be relevant in trauma, but also in sort of mental health challenges, you know, from people that doesn't have to be a diagnosed mental health illness, but people that struggle with, for example, a bit more anxiety than the other people, or people whose mood can be just a little bit lower. So perhaps say a little bit about some examples of that.
Well, there's for anxiety, there's a really important gene to look at called GAD1. That's the gene that turns glutamate, which makes us really intelligent and really focused. And it's good to have glutamate. You have to have it. But it's supposed to be turned into, take the GAD1 gene, turns it into GABA, which is now that's calming. And then there's a cycle. It goes back into glutamate and back around. So many people have issues with those GAD1 genes. And so they're not doing that. Now that creates a person who's very intelligent, but boy, they can't, you know, their whole life is full of anxiety and they don't even know it because they were this way since they were conceived as a baby. And so they come out of the womb and the world, you know, has its moments of anxiety, some a lot for some of us. And this is how you're reacting to the world. So you wouldn't stand up and say, well, I have a lot of anxiety, but you do. And these are the people that if they get into a stressful situation, they kind of lose it. Another one, start yelling at people around them, and later on they're very sorry. And so you can actually take a supplement. You can get GABA as a supplement and take that. They don't sleep well, so you want to take it enough of it so you find yourself sleeping well. But then another good example, I think it's a really important gene, is DRD2. And that's a dopamine gene that, and I've seen a lot of reports, people's, you know, gene reports, and this gene is amazingly underfunctioning in people. So dopamine, of course, makes you more focused and alert. It's a really important survival gene. So when people don't have enough dopamine, then they go out and they do things that are addictive. Or, I mean, you know, you could be shut in for a month or two or three with a virus, and then what do you know? You start playing a video game because you're bored to death, and then you get addicted because if you have these genes, it's an addiction gene. You become addicted to alcohol, to work, gambling, whatever. This gene is going to make you more likely to become addictive. So let's say you knew that and you think, boy, I have a tendency to be a workaholic. I have to stop, you know, bring more balance in my life. Another really important and very common gene is called COMT, C-O-M-T. So that gene is also a survival gene. If we get stressed out and you have and that gene's working slowly, your dopamine, adrenaline, noradrenaline, that all goes up. But now it stays up. You can't clear it. So even though the stress event is over, you're starting to feel okay, everything's okay, your dopamine's way up there, your adrenaline's way up there, and you can't relax, even if it's time to go to bed or something, you can't. So, you know, magnesium and CME are two really important things you can take to help bring that down. But also you would know to do yoga or stretching maybe before bedtime to stretch out some of that stress so you can sleep well. And then there's sleep genes. Like I have a gene variant called AANAT, and that is way down at the end of this pathway where you get tryptophan, which turns into like serotonin, into 5-HTP, and then finally serotonin turns into melatonin. But this gene comes in, and this gene isn't working very well, and it doesn't turn the serotonin into melatonin, so you don't get sleepy at night. So you're a good candidate to take a little melatonin to make you sleepy. Along that pathway, you'll see B6 coming in. It's a real, and then also SAMe again is helpful for turning that gene, making that gene work better. So there, I always find, like, I love to find the problem because I love to find the workaround for it. And people should know that knowing is good, because there's, I don't know anything that doesn't have a workaround around it for you.
And I think sometimes, particularly looking at it from the point of view of trauma and sort of mental health challenges, is that people can sometimes wonder, well, other people went through, perhaps someone had a good buddy or good friend they were growing up, but went through many of the same experiences, and that friend's doing just fine, but mm-hmm. they're feeling mm-hmm. a real kind of impact of those micro traumas, and they're wondering what the difference is. And it may be mm-hmm. that the difference is a different genetic makeup that might mm-hmm. have meant that perhaps someone's a little bit more susceptible, their system is a bit less resilient because of their mm-hmm. genetic mm-hmm. makeup.
Well, see, that's why I think it's so important, this new era that we're entering into. You know, many, many practitioners have never studied genes. This is so new to them. And if you jump right into it, it can seem complicated. And then you don't need to know all the different genes there, but there's certain ones I think that you definitely should know about yourself. Like, are you good at creating energy, or do you have mitochondria genes that make your mitochondria less, you know, give you energy? And let's say that your diet's really important. Well, there's a ton of information in our genes about the way we should be eating. And that you might be out there eating a lot of saturated fat because you are hearing how good the ketogenic diet is and even maybe feel better on it. But you have a gene like for example, APOE4, that person that chooses to be on a ketogenic diet with that gene, their risk for for Alzheimer's and cardiovascular disease is huge, like 85%. So you don't want to eat that diet because of that gene. And, you know, you don't never just look at one gene. You want to look at a group of them to see, but then you can advise people, here's what works. This is how you know yourself better. And that's where there's actually the biggest lagging of all at the moment, is there's not enough trained practitioners to help people. So, but, you know, a lot of people have gone out and done 23andMe and so on, but now they're finding that their customers have dropped significantly. Like, people aren't doing that. But I think that's because they mostly did it to find out, you know, how much Neanderthal they had in them, or, you know, where do they come from? But that's not really the good part of getting your genes tested. It's all that other amazing information that's hidden in your DNA, and you want to bring it out. And, you know, it's just gold in there as far as I see it. So
do you have any recommendations or preferences in terms of if people want to get their genes tested? Well, you know, you've just done a summit with, you know, dozens of kind of experts. I'm sort of curious mm-hmm. as to, yeah, what are some of your preferred pathways there?
Well, first of all, there's going to be more options coming out soon, but 23andMe, Ancestry, you know, that's more Ancestry, but 23andMe has their latest version out, and it's good. You can pull 23andMe into a program like I've got and populate it into these categories, and you start helping people. But there's Self-Decode. Joe Cohen, yeah. I interviewed.
In fact, Joe's on the conference, yeah.
Oh, great. Yeah. That's a must listen to. He's so, his blogs, everybody should read his blogs all the time, because you'll start to understand everything, really. It's like he's got this team of researchers that are doing an excellent job of writing and all. So that's a great place to study. And his Self-Decode gene test is good. He's bringing out a new chip with even more genes on it. So that's good. And then there's another company, Functional Genomic Analysis. There's a whole bunch of them, actually, yeah. A whole handful.
And I know Dr. Ben Lynch, I think, has got a...
Ben's got Strategene. Yeah. There's quite a few to choose from. So, you know, and they're not expensive. You know, 23andMe can be just $99 if you just buy the Ancestry part, but you get the other part too for the same $99. But, you know, the most expensive ones are like $200. So let's say, you know, 2 years from now, you decide to go back and use another company, then you can just do it over again, because there's more information coming out. But I like companies that give you a lot of practical information, like Joe does. And Joe and I are going to work together, and I'm steering people to his kit for my butterfly genomics, which is my training program, because that's really where there's a real need next, you know, because you want to go to somebody who sees this, your variant, and can tell you exactly what to do. And that, you know, I've got 30 years of experience there. So
let's pause this piece of the conversation. We'll come back to the genetics piece in a little bit. And let's just sort of open up the piece around digestion and sort of the relationship that that has to things like mood, to things like brain fog, because often when people have those sorts of symptoms, they cannot be aware that just because the symptoms are happening, for example, in the brain or in the emotions or the mood, the origin often is in the digestive system. I know this has been part of your work for many, many years. So just say a little bit about how that relationship, how digestion affects upon mood, mental health, and that side of things.
Well, it's a huge category.
And, I know, I'm sorry. I just gave you a very, very big open question there.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think. Well, in a nutshell, everything has to do with mood. So if your gut's messed up, you're very inwardly focused, noticing everything wrong. You become really a kind of what people might say, well, she's just neurotic or, you know, a hypochondriac or something, because it becomes, it's a brain, you know, like we've got the brain in our head, we've got this brain in our gut, and they're connected. Actually, the gut brain, I mean, I like to see it as just, we have a brain throughout our entire body, and they're a mass of cells in our head and another mass of cells down in our gut area. But they actually control the brain. It's hard to believe that. And some of the newer research is that the microbes in the gut are also in the brain in far less numbers. But they're, you know, how do they get there? Well, messages are constantly traveling from the gut up to the brain. 80 times, you know, like in 100 messages, 80 of them will be coming from the gut, 20 from the brain down to the gut. So you can see the gut's important. Now, living in the gut are trillions and trillions of microbes, every tiny little, like not just in the gut, like every tiny little piece of the gut has trillions, and they all have their own genes. So the genetic contribution, I guess you could say, to these microbes in our gut is just beyond anything we can understand. So what if they're bad? What if they're troublesome, like E. coli or, you know, C. difficile or any of the bad ones? And then the whole body's poisoned, not working properly, you know. So it's a really important place to start when you've got any kind of problem. You can't not be thinking of the gut, and that has almost become a battle cry for many functional medicine practitioners: first fix the gut. Now, that in itself is, you know, it takes more of a skilled person, but I think, and have, you know, tried to simplify it for people, because maybe you don't understand if you have a leaky gut and what do you do for that, and, you know, how to get the right microbes in your gut. If you're eating fermented foods, the right fermented foods, then a lot of healing begins to happen in the gut, and you're bringing in the right microbes that are producing the right substances. So they make, you know, so they make like folate, and many of the B vitamins are made, they make vitamin K, and they, so, you know, like I've been teaching people for years to eat fermented foods, like fermented vegetables, cultured vegetables. And, you know, there's like some interesting things to say just about that, if we can come back to that. But, but see, they're full of healthy bacteria, an unbelievable amount. And you eat a few spoonfuls with your meal, they're in the food that you just ate. So they're traveling down along your, you know, your digestive tract, and they're doing all these things. They're breaking the food down so you digest it better. They're extracting minerals. They're pulling out poisons that maybe, like, the food you just ate has glyphosate on it. You know, they're going to go right after that and get rid of it. So that's their job. They maybe you ate a meal with a bunch of E. coli in it, and you could get really sick, but they'll get rid of them right away. And so, you know, it's absolutely essential to have them. And and I think what's happened is that in countries like, say, Japan, where they have fermented foods in their diet, Russia always had sauerkraut, for example, you know, they never understood the science behind why they're so important. Many people immigrated, say, here to America, and they left behind, they didn't bring their fermented foods because they didn't understand how important they were. And even now, if I go to Japan and say, you know, so these little pickles that you eat and this miso soup and everything, you know, why do you eat it? And they'll say, oh, it's good for you. That's all they know. But I really, no, I wasn't the only one. Sally Fallon wrote a book and she talked about how cultures all over the world had always had something fermented. But I really was the one that explained how this inner ecosystem came into place and why it's there, where it starts at birth, how, I mean, critical it is to start at birth. Here's an interesting gene connection between our gut and our, the gut and the genes. So there's a gene called MUC2, and that gene makes mucus in our gut. Now, MUC5, A and B, make mucus in our the lining of our lungs. So, you know, you want that to be working in your lungs because you're more at risk for infections like the coronavirus, for example. Anyway, back to the gut, MUC2 is making mucus all along the lining of the gut. And that gene is there from the minute you're conceived, but it doesn't start working until some bacteria start eating the mucus, like Akkermansia, for example. So they eat the mucus, and then the gene wakes up and starts making mucus. And they need the mucus to, you know, they burrow into it and they live there. And so it's kind of a cool example. Another gene, FUT2. This is a really important gene for feeding the bacteria that are in there. So if you have, like, I'm an A, you're probably an O. You look like an O, right?
I am an A, yeah. No, yeah. Am I? No, I'm an A negative, sorry.
But, oh, you are? Yeah. Gosh, you look more like an O. Like, yeah. O's are more muscular and can't, anyway.
So. I used to look more like an A negative before I had kids, but that's another story for another day.
Well, by the way, people that are A's have been shown to be more at risk for getting sicker if they have the coronavirus. But anyway, I've been following blood type for many, many years, about 45 years. I've asked so many people their blood type. When I started working with kids with autism, I always asked their mom, what's your blood type? What's your son's blood type? Over and over and over again, they said A. So most of the children with autism are blood type A. So I like to know blood type. But our blood has different sugar in it. Like if you and I are A's, we have an A sugar and we secrete that sugar into the saliva, into our gut and tears. And we're feeding the bacteria like this in our sweat because there's bacteria that live in all these places and we're feeding them with that sugar. And if you are FUT2, have SNPs there, you're not doing that very efficiently. And so you've got this brand new little baby that's coming in the world and he needs bacteria, but he needs to feed that bacteria. And so if the mom has the FUT2 variant and the baby has it too, or one does, she doesn't make it in her milk. She's not feeding the bacteria from the beginning of the life. So you want to step in there with a little intervention and be sure that baby gets plenty of bifidus in the beginning of his life and keep doing that through the all of life. Keep nurturing that digestive system because you could have variants that I just did a consultation with somebody and she had variants in both those genes and all her life she's had gut problems. She's gone to every expert under the sun and she knew she had gut problems, but this helped her understand what was going on, what to fix, and why it's really literally started early in her life. So I think that's a great example of gene gut connection.
Yeah, and just how empowering it can be to have that insight and to have that clarity. Mm-hmm. I want to take a few steps back, Donna. You mentioned about fermented foods, and there'll be people watching this that will be very familiar with that, and others that will be what are fermented foods? So let's just give a little bit of context of just what you mean by fermented foods. Maybe a few examples of fermented vegetables and
Mm-hmm. Well, lately, I have been really into fermented beets because beets are an excellent source of nitric oxide. We have a commercial running all the time over here about how it gives you energy and, you know, it's drink beets, drink this juice. Anyway, yeah, beets are great, but they actually are very, very high in oxalates unless you ferment them. So I've recently, and I've got proof of that from university and all, but you don't want to be eating high oxalate foods. Now, and that's another whole story. They can go look that up on the internet. But so if you ferment foods that are high in oxalates, the bacteria in the fermented food eat the oxalates. So they're not causing those stones, kidney stones, stones in your muscles and bones and pain throughout your body. Because beets are good. They are a rich source of nitric oxide. But we just make them better when you ferment them. And how I do that is I'll take my latest recipe is I'll take red cabbage and beets. You know, you shred them up. I put in some carrots and a nice sweet onion, and then fennel. The fennel is really important. So then I take I shred it up and put it in a big bowl, and then I'll take like a blender and put water in it. And then I blend up three apples and put in our starter. And I'll explain why I do that. Put in some of our minerals. They're humic and fulvic minerals, and the bacteria love those minerals. So, and they like the sugar in the apples. So you blend that together and pour that over your vegetables, and you pack it into a jar and then let nature take over. And a week or 10 days later, they're ready to eat. That's how you make them. But the reason the beets are such a great thing to make is beets are one of the most important molecules in the body for fighting infections. And so imagine, just because you're eating beets, that you have built your immune system significantly. Nitric oxide is really important for circulation, so your heart gets better. Now, I know with the coronavirus, the heart was damaged. If the person recovered, they might have had heart damage, kidney damage. Kidney and heart are related in Chinese medicine. They're a yin-yang pair. So I just keep seeing these, things happening all over in this relationship. And then I think, well, this would help that condition. So fermented beets are great. And that's how easy it is to make them. Why I put the starter in there, though, is because you enormously up the amount of bacteria, particularly Plantarum. And Plantarum is an amazing microbe. It's like a Napoleon, he's like the leader of the pack, and he's going to get everybody lined up and get rid of some of them. And these over here, he says, you do this so that this little bacteria grows right beside you. They're super leaders. And probably Napoleon was a bad example because he wasn't such a great guy, but Alexander the Great or somebody like that. But he's like, they're really important to have them in your gut. And I actually have a paper right here. I thought of this because it says lactic acid bacteria efficiently protect human and animal intestinal line, the cells, the epithelial cells, it's the lining. Okay, so the lactic acid bacteria basically protect the immune cells from enteric virus infection, coronavirus, for example. So right there, and where does lactic acid bacteria? Well, that's what you get in fermented vegetables. Now, there are other fermented foods on the market, like beer and wine and kombucha, and I don't recommend those because, if you have them sometimes, you have a really small amount, but they contain a lot of wild yeast, wild fermentation, and you don't want that type of fermentation in your gut. You want to know what's in there, bifidus, lactobacillus, and akkermansia. So, it's a fascinating world in there, and you control it, really, by ultimately sort of everything comes back to what we do, making things work. And so this is how you control the microbiome. The other thing we sell that actually takes a lot of work, but I think it's important to know, we get grains and seeds and biodynamic rice and chickpeas. They're grown in New Zealand, Australia, and brought in and fermented in a culture. Now, then they're exposed to antibiotics, which kill most of them, but there's some left. And you just grow those out. They're exposed to birth control pills. Some are left. You grow those out. So we have a liquid, a probiotic liquid that comes over in a refrigerated air container. And then either a refrigerated ship or an air container, we get them here as fast as we can. And they're super potent. But what is special about them and about fermented vegetables is the diversity that they bring into the gut. And that is extremely critical. It's not like just take this bifidus or take this group of, bacteria. It's the diversity and its natures. Like on every single quinoa, every single one, there's like jillions of them. They have their own little microbiome. Every grain of rice, every little chickpea, they each have their own microbiome. We don't even say what bacteria are in our products because there's no way to tell. Because every time you make a batch, you get trillions of, grains and or grain-like seeds, and then so the diversity is just extraordinary, and that is the most important thing of all. That's what builds a really strong immune system.
That's really cool, and I'm just thinking, Donna, as well, for So there's the fermented food piece that can have a really strong impact in terms of supporting immunity, digestive function, and these pieces. One of the other questions I think people often have, and I think particularly as we're talking about both genetics and digestion, is how about day-to-day diet and what people should be eating? There are so many contradictory opinions out there. And we talked, you mentioned blood type earlier. Mm-hmm. That's another, mm-hmm. that's an example mm-hmm. of a system around eating according to blood type. Mm-hmm. What can genetics help inform us? Like, how important is bio-individuality in terms of what someone eats, and can mm-hmm. genetics mm-hmm. help guide that?
Well, let's look at the MCM6 gene. That's a dairy. Now, you know, there's a lot of controversy over dairy. Around the world, millions of people eat yogurt. They drink kefir, both examples of fermented. I think, you know, this gene, the MCM6 gene, is a, if you have variants there, and I actually do, two genes, and I have, they're what's called homozygous, meaning my mom and my dad both gave me a variant. So that would look bad. Maybe you think, wow, you're really going to have a if this gene is the gene that digests milk, variant, you still retain the ability to digest lactose all through your life. So most people, the majority, actually lose the ability to digest lactose. So if they keep drinking milk after they're weaned, they can have digestive problems, stomach aches and all. So you can see that this person has these variants and say, you know, you have retained the ability to digest milk sugar, but you don't really want that milk sugar anymore. You're way better off taking the milk and fermenting it because it's going to be more digestible and it's going to have this great bacteria. In the case of yeast, it has kefir, it has wonderful yeast in it, which are really good to put in the digestive tract. So that's something you can find out and, you know, steer them into a better. However, dairy has fat in it. So the person might be having, they're kind of wondering why they're reacting to the dairy. Well, it could be that it's their gut. Like maybe the gut's open and inflamed, or there's someone who's always constipated. So those are two times when dairy's not good for you. But also, maybe you could do just fine on fermented dairy if you did with the low-fat version and got rid of the fat, because you have a problem with fat. And that's in the genes. It's all in the genes. And then, you know, just, oh, and then the other thing is the quality of milk. In most of our countries, America, England, you know, New Zealand, Australia, Canada, all of our countries that I know better, we've been getting our milk from an A1 cow, which means that there is a type of casein that we don't digest, basically. And so mother's milk is A2 casein, goats, every other mammal, really. And in America, you know, in the cow world, you want to get your milk from a real ancient cow or even like a Jersey cow because they produce A2 milk. So even the quality of milk you're using is important. But so I brought in the digestion piece and I brought in the gene piece. And that's why obviously we're gut smart, gene smart. But it's really good to tie all that together. And so the person goes away and says, oh, wow, you know, I can be eating fermented dairy. I should be making it from A2 milk. And then the other thing is, let's say you've avoided it for a really long time. Then you can't just throw it in your body because the microbes in your gut don't know what it is. So what you want to do is introduce it slowly. So maybe take just a tablespoon of your fermented kefir that you make at home real easily, and just put a tablespoon in some water and drink that for about a week or 10 days. And what's happening is the microbes are saying, wow, what's this? Let's organize ourselves here so that we can figure out how to digest this stuff. And then next thing you know, you're fine with it. So I've done that a lot with children with autism because they shouldn't have dairy, but their mothers eventually, when they're recovered, they say, well, I really like to get dairy back in his diet, but, you know, and so we found that that works. I don't know about for everybody, but it's worked a lot. So did that answer that question?
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I think there's something about one, deciding what they eat with as much data as they can from different sources. And mm-hmm. it might well be that someone's got a genetic vulnerability and they're getting away with eating something, but the body's mm-hmm. having to work really hard to sort of to compensate and make that work. And they may find that even though they're not noticing symptoms eating it, they cut it out, they actually notice that they feel so much better for it.
Well, another example, the word kefir. Well, kefir originally is supposed to have originated from Turkey. And if you translate kefir in Turkey, it means feel good. So fermented foods have an enormous effect on feeling good. And our best example of that is our babies. So what I'd like to do is work with women when they're pregnant, because our diet's fantastic for them. And then the baby's born and they're giving all this good bacteria to the baby, just like they're supposed to. But the babies themselves need to have an inner ecosystem established. And this is very strange thinking. I'm sure no one has ever heard this before. But what we do is we take, the mothers are drinking like fermented, either the kefir, maybe they're fermenting coconut water, they're eating fermented vegetables throughout the pregnancy. So what we recommend is that you take some juice from the fermented vegetables and dilute it in water and put it in the baby's mouth when he's a few days old, because they never have colic. They always start off life, you know, and they digest everything and they're really alert. But that or the milk kefir, well, actually in Russia, they start their babies on milk kefir at 4 months. And then that's why Russians digest milk throughout their life, because they keep that microbiome going. But even the, you know, the coconut kefir in there, in the baby's gut. So things start off just like they're supposed to. What is very consistently true is those children are different. They're very happy. They're happy children. They're a joy to raise. They're just, you know, if you have a child who's screaming with colic in the beginning of his life, you're trying to bond with him versus this child who's like, loves to eat, you know, smiling all the time, developing really well, you know, it's a whole different world. And so these kids grow up and they're talking at an earlier age because, you know, that gut brain development is so critical in the beginning. Anyway, that's very consistent with our babies, is the happiness factor. So I just think that's the best proof of all. Now, these microbes in your gut, they're making neurotransmitters and all too. So, you know, there's definitely, it's all tied together. Everywhere I look, you can see a connection between a healthy gut and, you know, eating right in a certain way. And if you never know what your genes are, they'll be working for you. If you never get them tested, you'll be doing the right things. If you focus on the gut, add the fermented foods. Now, you'll also see criticisms of fermented vegetables, for example, like they are higher in glutamate, which again is contributing to intelligence. But I've never seen that ever be a problem. But another criticism is when people have SIBO, they say don't eat fermented things like beer and wine and kombucha and fermented vegetables. Well, you know, there's something important to know about that, because maybe you can eliminate them initially, but you don't want to constantly have SIBO reoccurrence over and over again. You got to get that healthy gut established. So this is why Plantarum is such a cool bacteria, because so we make our vegetables with the Plantarum, and Plantarum is fantastic at degrading histamine. So now you start off with a little bit of properly made, you know, fermented vegetables like we teach, introduce that. And then people don't have a histamine reaction because you've got the Plantarum in there taking care of the histamine for you. So anyway, that there's a misunderstanding of fermented foods. They're not all alike. And you use properly, even therapeutically at the right time, you know, you need them. We need to go back into them and not just blatantly say, well, I have SIBO, so I can't ever eat any fermented foods. You know, there's more to that story.
Donna, you're a powerhouse of information. And I'm thinking the people that are listening to this that are feeling sort of feeling. I wasn't going to say that. I was going to say feeling inspired, actually, in terms of the potential to get greater clarity on both genetics, but also particularly on what's going to support their digestion, given the impact that you talked about earlier between what's happening in one's digestion and how that impacts upon mental and emotional health. What I'm sort of wondering is what, where should someone start? So someone's sort of realizes the potential here, but is not quite sure, well, what do they do next? What's your kind of general recommendation for that?
Okay, so I figured that out when I started working with children with autism. So far, no one had recovered any. And we brought a group of moms together, and their kids started getting well. They all have yeast infections. They all have gut problems. They're not good detoxifiers, and they have to do certain, most of them, more about 80% of them, have a gene called MTHFR, which actually has a lot to do with neurotransmitters and with detoxing. Anyway, so you can see certain things about them. Not detoxifying is a big thing, but so that's when I also kind of came up. Was just, the mothers would ask this all the time. When do we start? How do we start? And so the kids won't eat anything. You know, they like the crust around pizza, and that's all they'll eat. You know what I mean? They're just really into carbs, really into bread, and they're picky eaters. And so, you know, they won't eat broccoli. You can't say, well, they need vegetables. So what I learned to do is start them on the fermented foods. Like with the fermented vegetables, you could put a bowl of chips, like corn chips, around, you know, like in a plate, and put these vegetables in there. And then they just get, they kind of like to use their fingers, and also they're like, just use it like a dip and start eating it. And then they like it a lot. Next thing you know, they're always eating it. Same with the coconut kefir. That was a really important food for helping them recover, is that, you know, it's a fermented, it's the same starter that we use to make milk kefir, but we're now putting it in coconut water because they can't do dairy. So they'd start drinking it. Sometimes they loved it, sometimes they didn't, so they have to hide it in some junky juice. But in a few days, they didn't need the junky juice anymore. They liked it. And then, so there's a whole bunch of genes, taste buds in our mouth that are controlled by genes, by the way, and the brain is becoming involved here. Next thing you know, they're drinking a whole lot of it. Like mothers would say, well, he's drinking a lot of this. Do you think he'll become an alcoholic? Like, I can't get him to stop drinking it. And we said, no, give him as much as they want. The ones that drank a lot had faster progress, but they were fixing their gut. They're changing their brain. Next thing you know, they're crawling up in their mom's lap, eating her broccoli off of her plate. So I would say start there. Just do your best. You know, like some kids and people, they don't like the vegetables. So, and also with babies, we puree them very fine. So they don't look like chunky. You know, it depends on how you can shred them as fine as you want them. But maybe they have a problem with chunky things. And so you can puree them. But I always found that if we could just get them to start there, everything else started falling into place over time. And then here's another thing. Like, I know you've got great people on your summit that are talking about many different things, yoga and many, many different things. But in this case, all the parents did have their children in speech therapy and other different types of therapy. And none of it was working until they fixed the gut, started coming out of their shell and becoming present. Like at that speech class, they were really working to learn, you know, how to talk better. They, once they come out, they retain so much knowledge that when they are back into the world, they're very eager to catch up and learn as fast as they can. But also very importantly that they even very often, I would see them, you know, taking over and advancing, you know, I want this, mom, I want that, I'm not eating pizza anymore. You know, I would be really surprised at how they were wanting to get well, yeah, too. So that was a great training for me. The years I worked with families, we had over 2,000 at one time of practitioners and families coming through our Bedrock group, which stands for Body Ecology Diet Recovering Our Kids. And we had left that information up there, but I stopped working because I became so frustrated with the political stuff that started coming in, the pharmaceutical companies, and nobody was talking about prevention, and it's easy to prevent it. Yeah. So that's what we do, is we try to prevent it. And it's the gut. I didn't know anything about the genes, but when you look at the genes, you know, they're not any different from the rest of us with gene variants. Yeah. I don't think it's a gene issue, frankly.
Donna, I'm mindful of time, but I know there'll be people that want to find out more. What's the best way for people to find out more about you and your work?
Well, our website is bodyecology.com. So hopefully they'll go there. And I just apologize if I said too much.
Not
I feel
at all.
Like I'm rambling here.
Not at all. I think it's really, really fascinating. And Donna, thank you so much for your time and contribution. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you.